Physics World.
Hello and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Margaret Harris, and this week we'll mostly be talking about the role that computing plays in physics. In particular, we've gotten an interview coming up later with a group of quantum computing researchers at Hitachi Cambridge Laboratory and the University of Strathclyde. They'll be explaining how you might construct lots and lots of quantum bits, or qubits, using silicon. And we'll also take some time at the end of the podcast for the answers to last week's Physics in Film quiz. But first, I'm joined in the studio by my colleague Tammy Freeman, who's here to talk about some of the latest news from the world of medical physics. Hi, Tammy.
Hi.
Okay, so what's caught your attention this week?
Okay, so one interesting article that we've just published reports on the first human images acquired using a new positron emission tomography scanner, or a PET scanner, that's being developed at the University of Pennsylvania. It's called the PenPET Explorer.
Catchy name.
Yeah. So PET scanning is basically, it's a medical imaging technique that involves injecting the patient with a radioactive tracer that emits positrons. Now these positrons, they collide with tissue and annihilate to create photon pairs that trigger signals in detectors placed outside the body. So there's lots of types of PET tracer, but the most common one, it detects glucose metabolism, which is increased in tumours. So by detecting areas of increased signal, you can basically see regions of cancer within the patient.
Okay, yeah.
So the difference with the new scanner is it has a large axial field of view. So this means it can image a large length of a patient or even a whole body in one scan, as opposed to stitching together a sequence of scans. The ability to image the entire body, it can reduce the amount of tracer that you need, or it can reduce the scan time.
Okay.
So the PenPET is one of two whole body PET images being developed by a US-based consortium, Explorer, which was formed back in 2015. The other system is being developed at UC Davis, and the scanner there is just under 2 meters long. Now, the PenPET scanner it's currently got three rings of detectors and a field of view of 64 centimetres, and the team plan to add on another three detector rings, which would increase the scanner length to 1.4 metres. So you can see you're almost getting up to the whole body at that point.
Yeah, certainly most of it.
Yeah, so in this study, they use the PenPET Explorer to image a series of patients and healthy volunteers and just investigate the advantages of the scanner. So they showed, for example, that it produces higher quality images than a state-of-the-art commercial PET scanner using the same scan time, or it can produce equivalent images but with a reduced scan time. So they cut it down from 16 minutes to 2 minutes, and it was still just as good as the commercial one.
So that's nice. It means you don't have to spend quite so much time in your scanner, which I presume is really useful for people who are, you know, claustrophobic or small children who can't stay still that long.
Exactly. So you can shorten the time. And the other thing that you can do, which they demonstrated, is you can get equivalent images with the same time but using a lower dose of tracer.
Okay. Because there is a radioactive tracer, so you don't want any more of them in your body than is medically necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So are there any other benefits of having a PET scanner that can image the whole body?
Yeah. So one other thing that the team did was they performed dynamic imaging over an hour to watch the tracer uptake.
Okay.
So basically they could see the tracer moving from the blood, the circulatory system, into the organs. And you can only do this if you've got a scanner with a long field of view.
Okay. Yeah, because of course the blood moves around, so if it goes out of the field of vision, then you've lost, you didn't know what happened to
it.
So what are the team doing next?
Okay, well, according to the senior author, Joel Karp, they plan to undertake as many studies as possible that take advantage of this large axial field of view. And they're also performing tests to submit the system for FDA approval, which is the US regulatory system. And once they've done that, they'll be able to perform more clinical studies. And they're also hoping to do some pediatric studies with colleagues at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
So better news for children with possible cancers and diagnosis and treatment.
Yeah.
Excellent. So that article was PenPET Explorer Acquires First Human Images, and it was written by our freelancer, Cynthia Keane. Now, there was another paper out recently, Tammy, I think you also wanted to talk about, not least because it does actually tie in with the computing theme of this week's podcast. And I believe it's about the use of artificial intelligence, or AI, in diagnosing, is it skin cancer, is that right?
Yes. So, normally, when you diagnosing skin conditions, this usually begins with a visual examination by a doctor. And if skin cancer suspected. They might follow it up with a biopsy where they take some tissue and test it to confirm the diagnosis. But another newly emerging approach is to use artificial intelligence, AI, or algorithms that are trained to recognise different types of skin condition from images. So this paper looked at an AI-powered algorithm that aims to diagnose skin conditions of all types, not just cancers. Mm-hmm. The app, which was created by a US company called First Derm, is a free tool, and basically users upload photos of their skin lesions and the app suggests the most likely diseases that it thinks matches the photos.
So I've got some sort of ugly skin condition. I take a photo of it, upload the app, and it tells me, oh dear.
It might be eczema,
yeah. It might be skin cancer, it might be some other sort of horrible thing I might have.
Yeah, so basically the app is powered by a convolutional neural network that was trained using over 300,000 images of skin diseases, from inflammatory conditions such as acne and psoriasis to skin cancers. Now, it has an accuracy of about 80% for its top three suggestions, and its top suggestion is about 45% accurate.
So that means in practice that if it tells me I might have skin cancer or psoriasis or liver spots or something, then in that order, then the top diagnosis is 45% accurate.
Yeah, so possibly best checking with the doctor.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So that all sounds really useful, but I understand that there's a problem that researchers have found with the database of images that is used to train these AIs to detect cancer and other skin conditions.
Yes, so the founder and CEO of First Derm, Alexander Bourvais, he knew that the training data set only contained about 5 to 10% of images of black skin. So what he did is he's teamed up with researchers at the Medical Concierge Group in Uganda to test the app on photographs of skin disease in adults with dark brown to black skin. Now, the results weren't great. So the version of the app that they used suggested 5 possible skin conditions for each image that it looked at. And it only included the correct diagnosis in this top 5 in 17% of the images.
Ooh.
So basically for 102 out of the 123 photographs that they tested, the app failed to return any correct suggestions.
Ooh, so that's a really serious problem. What did the researchers do to address it?
Well, basically they say that this research will serve as a benchmark for the company, and it will hopefully aim to improve the app with future updates by increasing the diversity of images that the AI is trained on. So Alexander Bourvais says that they need at least 500 images per skin disease to train the neural networks. And now they're sort of realising they also need 500 images of each different skin type.
Right, okay. So all the shades from dark skin types to very pale ones.
Yeah.
Okay. So this story kind of fascinates me because I think it combines the sort of promises of AI in science and medicine with one of its huge pitfalls, and that's the old programmer's adage of garbage in, garbage out. If your data set is rubbish, and in this case it's actually more than rubbish, it's actually, frankly, racist, then your results are going to be rubbish. You're not going to be able to diagnose skin conditions in the whole population. And it's really good to see that being addressed.
Yes.
But weirdly, it's not the only example I've seen of AI producing wrong results in skin cancer diagnosis. So in 2018, a researcher called Janelle Shane, who writes a marvelous blog called AI Weirdness and is an expert in the ways that AI can go wrong. Now, she wrote an article for Physics World called Neural Networks Explained. Neural networks are a type of artificial intelligence algorithm, essentially. And you can read that article on our website, which is physicsworld.com. But in that article, Janelle Shane described how a clinical dermatologist called Roberto Novoa, who's at Stanford University in the US, or at least he was when he did this research, he developed an algorithm to recognize skin cancer. Great idea. The problem was that all the biggest, ugliest, nastiest looking skin cancers in Novoa's data set had been photographed with a ruler next to them to show the size of the skin lesion for scale. But the AI looked at those images and basically it learned that if there's a ruler in the image, then it's probably skin cancer. So what he and his colleagues actually developed was an algorithm that can recognize rulers.
Okay, so yeah, that's even less helpful.
Yeah.
But I mean, we have also recently written about an example where AI in medicine does work really well. So we've reported on another study. Now, this was from 4 medical centres on 3 different continents that showed that deep learning, a type of artificial intelligence, can improve radiologists' detection of lung cancers on chest x-rays. So chest x-rays are the most common imaging exam used to screen for lung cancer. However, the size and density and location of lung lesions, it makes detecting them on chest x-rays actually quite challenging. So in this study, there were 12 radiologists and they interpreted 800 randomly picked chest x-rays. Mm-hmm. And then they reread the same x-rays, but with the help of the deep learning software, which was trained to detect lung nodules. And this process actually improved the average sensitivity by just over 5%. And it also reduced the number of false positive findings.
Okay, so basically the key is not to sort of replace the researchers entirely with an AI, but it's to use the AI to help the researchers become better at diagnosing.
Yeah, that's something I'm seeing quite a lot, actually. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So we just talked about a couple of examples of using AI within diagnostic imaging, but you said you'd seen a lot of this happening. What other areas of medical physics are using AI as well?
Yeah, definitely. So one example, at this year's ESTRO, which is one of the major radiation oncology conferences, one of the main themes that I saw there was the introduction of AI into radiation therapy. So this was evident both in the conference talks and at the trade show, where companies were introducing AI into treatment planning and organ segmentation. And
what's organ segmentation?
That's just sort of when you take the image that you're going to plan the treatment on and sort of work out, okay, that's the tumour and that's the heart.
Yeah.
And sort of just
Yeah, you want to make sure the tumour bits and the non-tumour bits that you don't want to target.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think the aim here is to provide both faster and more consistent radiotherapy planning and ultimately also enable online adaptive radiotherapy where you can sort of create a personalised treatment plan in a few minutes according to the patient's particular position that day. And in fact, we ran a webinar earlier today looking at machine learning in the radiotherapy workflow. So I think this is going to be quite a big application for AI.
Excellent.
Another interesting application that I've seen is using AI to predict how a cancer will progress and evolve.
Oh, okay.
So, for example, researchers at the Institute of Cancer Research and the University of Edinburgh, they're developing a technique that picks out patterns in DNA mutations within cancers and uses this information to forecast future genetic changes. So this could help doctors choose which are the best treatments for the patient and remove some of the problems arising from cancer's unpredictability. And for example, if tumours with certain patterns perhaps are found to develop resistance to a particular treatment, this technique could help predict whether a patient would develop that resistance in the future.
Okay.
So that's another interesting application of AI.
Because at the moment it's quite difficult sometimes, you may know the size of the cancer and there's some tests that can tell, I know there's certain breast cancers that are hormone sensitive and that sort of thing, but you may not necessarily know just pick up on the basis of the size what the cancer is going to do next. So if there's a tool that helps clinicians figure that out.
It could really help personalise treatment for patients.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Tammy. So we've been talking about several articles about AI in medicine. And now, as I said, the theme of this week's podcast is computing. And at this point, I should probably mention that we published an entire report about physics and computing earlier this month. It's called The Physics World Focus on Computing. And if you're a member of the Institute of Physics, you will have actually received this issue already with your November copy of Physics World. You can't miss it. It's got a very snazzy, slightly 70s lime green cover on it. But if you're not a member of the Institute is also available in a free digital version via the Physics World app, which you can download in either Apple or Android versions, or you can access it via your web browser. Now, so I really enjoyed editing this report on computing because it's really an exciting time in the world of computing. We've just been hearing about machine learning applications in medical physics, and those are some important developments taking place in what you might call classical computing. But also in quantum computing, is as regular listeners of the podcast will know, is becoming an increasingly important field within physics. And here to talk about this quantum side of things are the authors of one of the articles in this Physics World Focus on Computing. The article is called Manufacturing Silicon Qubits at Scale, and its authors are Fernando González Zalba, Tsung-Ya Yang, and Alessandro Rossi. Welcome to the podcast. Maybe you could start out by introducing yourselves, just saying who you are and what you do.
Hi, I'm Tsung-Ya Yang. I I joined Hitachi as a research scientist about 7 years ago, and my role here is mainly focusing on electronic devices. And so for example, I do characterization of the electronic devices, mainly in semiconductors. And so we do the characterization of those devices at room temperature and very low temperature, and we want to find out if we can use those electronic devices for quantum information processing purpose. So the material we focus on here is mainly silicon, because silicon is a very mature technology, and it won't be too difficult to fabricate those devices. And we know silicon devices can be used for several day-to-day applications, like mobile phone computers. So we want to know if we can also use silicon devices for quantum computing.
And Alessandro?
Okay, my name is Alessandro Rossi, and I am a researcher working across two institutions. So I have a joint appointment at the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington near London, and I have also another appointment at the University of Strathclyde in Glasgow. And my research interests are really well reflected by the nature of this joint appointment, because the National Physical Laboratory is the UK Institute of Metrology, and so they are interested in developing new ways of maintaining and improving upon national standards of measurement, like, for instance, the one I work on intensively and have been working on for the past 10 years is the redefinition of the unit ampere, and they want to do this using quantum technologies. The other side of my research interest is on quantum computing, and this is an area where there is a lot of interest at the University of Strathclyde. They have a core expertise in atomic-based quantum computing, and now they want to expand on the solid-state quantum computing, and this is where I come about with my interest in semiconductor-based quantum devices. That's it, I think.
Okay. And Fernando?
Thanks, Alessandro. My name is Fernando González Alba. I'm the head of quantum computing at the Hitachi Chemisch Laboratory, where we are right now. The Hitachi Chemisch Laboratory is part of Hitachi Europe Ltd. So my role here is to coordinate the group of researchers that we have. So it's plus three researchers, plus me, working on silicon-based quantum computing. And then also we have a number of collaborations with different institutions, primarily with the University of Cambridge. And this is materialized by having some PhD students that work with the two, with Hitachi and with the university. So also I take care of supervising these students from the industrial side. My technical expertise is on the development of the readout techniques for quantum computing. So if you think that classical computers have hard drives and you need a read head to read the information from those hard drives, what my expertise here is to develop the quantum equivalent of a hard drive head for readout of semiconductor-based qubits.
Okay. So all three of you, you've said a little bit about what you work on. All three of you are working on what you call in the article you wrote for Physics World, sort of more than Moore electronics. Now, this is a reference to Moore's law, which was formulated sort of 50 or so years ago. And it predicts that the number of transistors on a silicon chip will double approximately 18 months. And along with that, the speed at which the chip can perform computations will also double. But that's coming to an end. And in fact, it started it's tailing off a little bit a few years ago. Can you explain why that is?
Okay, if we look at this Moore's law, yeah, it says the number of transistors doubles every 18 months to 2 years. So that also means the size of the transistors must be shrunk, smaller and smaller. And that will lead to physical limits, because eventually we cannot make the devices super small, because we just cannot do it. There's a limit for the size. And also, the other limit is that if we shrink the size of the transistors, there will be some issues. For example, current leakage, and that will also lead to a larger power consumption. So in order to, well, the one solution to overcome this limit is that we can use those existing technology for other purpose. For example, we can use the same or similar devices for not the classical computing, but maybe we can use it for quantum computing, because for quantum computing, maybe we don't need such small sizes of those transistors. So that here we are thinking about using those classical silicon transistors for quantum computing applications. And that the advantage of using those silicon technology for quantum computing is that, first, because those technology is already very matured, so we don't need to invest extra time to develop this manufacturing. So we can easily adapt this technology for quantum computing purpose. And secondly is that we can just simply use those silicon foundry to do the fabrication, because now if we look at those academic labs, actually we cannot be better than the professional foundries, because they focus on the fabrication for too many years and they can do the job very well. That's why we are looking at collaborating with those foundries to do the fabrication, but we can do the design of those circuits or the devices, but using their technology.
Okay.
And that's why that's the way we can still maybe follow the Moore's law, but use it for different applications.
Okay, so you've said that one of the big advantages of silicon basically is you can build on decades of engineering and decades and indeed facilities that are dedicated to making silicon-based circuits. What are the other advantages that silicon brings to making qubits?
Yes, so this is true. I mean, as Seung-Gi told us, definitely one of the great advantages of silicon is the fact that there is a very mature manufacturing technology that has been developed throughout the past half a century, and this has brought about the modern digital age. So the fact that we have laptop computers in front of us at the moment, we have more smartphones in our pocket that are the equivalent of supercomputers if you compare with the computing power available just a few decades ago, is all coming from the fact that silicon has been improved and technologically ameliorated throughout decades. And so we can transfer this expertise into a new direction that could be quantum computing, with some technical differences. But there is more than this. There is more than just reusing previous knowledge in using silicon as a quantum bit candidate. A quantum bit is basically the heart of the quantum processor, and is basically the equivalent of a bit of information in our laptop computers. Silicon has got an advantage when it's embodying a quantum bit compared to other implementation, because there are out there, we have to say, other ways of making qubits. For instance, the recent report from Google where they demonstrated a quantum processor that is more powerful than any available supercomputer was superconductor technology. So I want to stress this clearly. It was not made of a silicon chip. It was made of an exotic material that is cooled down and becomes superconductive. So it doesn't have any resistance when the current flows through it. Whereas what we focus more is on silicon chips and using silicon transistor as candidate. The advantage is, as I was about to say, is in the fact that silicon is a very quiet environment for these qubits. which means that the quantum information can be stored in a silicon qubit for much longer than any competing technology, including the one that Google has just reported recently. And this is why, because basically silicon can be isotopically purified, so we can very much control all the sources of noise inside the material, ranging from thermal noise to magnetic noise. And what we need to do now is demonstrate that silicon qubit can be scaled up. So we know that at individual qubit level is basically much better than the competition, but we need to demonstrate that when we scale it up and put hundreds, thousands, or millions of these transistor qubits together, they work as expected. And this is where, for instance, superconductor technology has taken the lead, and silicon should demonstrate that it can follow up very closely.
Okay, so what are some of the challenges of doing that? Well, you've talked about the advantages of silicon. I mean, everything has advantages and disadvantages. What are some of the things you have to overcome?
So the main thing to overcome is, for instance, taking the device variability at single transistor level and reducing that, so making sure that each transistor works absolutely in a sort of identical way to another one. So at the moment, when we do experiments on these transistor quantum bits, we see that there is some variability that is a little bit unpredictable, and we need to improve on the material technology to make sure that this variability at the quantum level are absolutely fixed before we can scale it up to many qubits in the same silicon chip. Another problem is that we need to solve the input-output problem, which means that we cannot expect to wire each quantum bit one by one, but we need to have a clever scheme to make sure that with a limited number of wiring, we can address a large quantum processor that has got many qubits from million to billions in them. And this is also possible thanks to the decades of expertise in silicon integrated circuit technology. Another thing that we need to improve upon certainly is the integration between the electronics that allows one to control the quantum processor and the electronics that makes the quantum processor itself. So there is two layer of electronics that can be both made in silicon, but they can also be in the future integrated on the same chip. At the moment, they reside on different chips in different instruments, whereas in the future, one could think of embedding everything on a single monolithic chip that would be much more commercially implementable, commercially viable, and also in terms of performance more enhanced, much more improved.
Okay. So the three of you, Sunya and Alessandra and also Fernando, who we haven't heard much from yet, you're all members of an international collaboration called the Mosquito Project, which stands for Metal Oxide Semiconductor-Based Quantum Information Technology. You can see why you call it Mosquito for short. So this project, I know, includes industrial partners like Hitachi Cambridge Laboratory and also universities and government labs across Europe. Can you tell me a bit more about what this project is aiming to do?
Yes. My colleagues have been talking about the benefits of using silicon and using the nanofabrication capabilities that the semiconductor industry offers. And until the start of the Mosquito project, there were several scientific reports out there showing the potential of silicon qubits for quantum computation. However, the devices used for these reports were devices made in university centers with non-conventional nanofabrication techniques. So, meaning that the scaling that technology using standard semiconductor fabs is non-trivial. So the project that we had in our hands, the Mosquito project that we proposed to the European Commission, so this is a European Commission H2020 project, we proposed the idea or the question, we wanted to answer the question, can we demonstrate a silicon qubit on a technology, a transistor technology that comes from a silicon fab and is manufactured at the scale of 300 millimeter wafers, which is the current wafer size of semiconductor classical electronics. So that was the question that we proposed to answer. And during the course of the last 3 years and a half, a collaboration, international collaboration of several institutions, starting from CEA, LETI in Grenoble, France, the University College London, VTT, a nanofabrication facility in Finland, the University of Copenhagen, the École Polytechnique of Lausanne, and CNRS in Italy. All these several institutions took the challenge and decided to answer this question. And over the course of the project, we've indeed demonstrated that with silicon transistor technology, you can have qubits. So this is a major milestone for the field, because it means that using the same nanofabrication capabilities that you have for the very large scale integrated circuits, we could potentially build large integrated quantum circuits. So the project itself is finished now. We finished this September. But because of the success of the project, now we have very clear ways of thinking and proposing how to scale from the one qubit that we've demonstrated right now. So that's our reality. And now we want to go move to the many qubits. So that's our next stage, scale up the technology and demonstrate the next research question and technological question that we want to answer is, can we scale up these technologies to a number of qubits that will not be able to be reached by any other means, by any other technology? If that's the case, if we can answer positively that question, it will mean that the technology, the hardware that will take quantum computing to the next stage, not to the current stage that is known as the noisy intermediate scale quantum, to take us to the next stage, we need a technology scalable enough, and we believe that silicon, with the very large scale integration capabilities, is the one that is going to take us there, to the many qubits, to the 1,000 qubits, or even more.
Okay. So I appreciate the project is now finished, but I just wanted to get a bit of a feel for from each of you what it was like to sort of work as part of this massive industry, academia, government labs collaboration. Maybe you could start, Fernando, since we just talked with you.
Yes. I think for projects as ambitious as this one, that also have a very clear technological application, it is essential to have a synergy between academia and industry. So there is a lot of knowledge and a lot of initial development coming from university. So this is one of the roles of the university, to break the walls of knowledge and come up with new ideas. But also, ultimately, for the scaling and the product development, there is the necessity as well to involve industrial partners, because ultimately the university is not a commercialization center. It is industry, the one that should take the role of developing that technology to make it sufficiently mature, such as it can be commercialized, it can be used for the good of society. So this is an ingredient that is essential in any project of this type of scale, that it has a very clear commercial and technological application. So having said that, in the particular case of the Hitachi Chemical Laboratory and Hitachi Europe, we are a special case of industry, because we are still very much geared to fundamental research. So one of the things that might be important to note is, and probably already comes across, is that quantum computing is still at very early stages of development. This is very early days, So some of the steps that need to be done are still very fundamental, very geared towards discovery. So the Hitachi Chemical Laboratory, although it's part of a company, we are geared towards the fundamental research side of things. So the collaboration between our center and university partners is relatively straightforward because we have the same mentality of development, proof of concept, and increased development. Maybe
if I may add something here, Mark.
Maybe Alessandro.
Let's hear from the academic side, from you, Alessandro.
From my point of view, from the academic side, why it is important to have these synergies with industry. So I would say there are two good reasons. One is that the research councils all around the world, from US, Europe, of course, UK, want to fund more increasingly more research that has clear benefit and a clear impact for society. So having industrial partners in these grant application where substantial amount of money needs to be devoted to develop new technology is a testament to the fact that there is an interest for the technology being developed, even if it's at an early stage, like Fernando was saying, but there is a commercial interest and there are partners that have basically this interest inside the consortium to take up the technology the moment it matures enough, which means that there is a clear prospect for benefits and impact in society. So from a very pragmatic point of view of an academic, having industry in my grant application has higher chances of success of being funded from this side. The other interesting part, and I think an important point of view, is that when I think of a new project for a grant application, if I know that I want to involve partners in industry such as Hitachi or others, I need to keep my feet on the ground, and so it helps me to write applications and to think of research projects that have a clear technological outlet, clear technological application, and so it makes me wonder less in the area of, you know, blue sky research where basically you do research for the sake of research. And of course, there are situations where you want to do that type of research, and that in that case, maybe you don't create such a strong synergy with industry. But in the specific case where you have in mind a clear technological application, then from the outset of the project conception, you want to have these partners that steer your goals and the aims of your research.
Okay, Sungya, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think as Fernando and Alessandro mentioned, Hitachi Cambridge Lab is a very special case because we're physically embedded in the campus of University of Cambridge. So we can very easily have conversation with other academic research groups on regular basis, and we can also easily share our resources and ideas with each other. And I think it's like a two-way communication that we can let those academic research groups understand what are the needs of the industry, and we can also easily know what are the focus of those academic research groups. And also, because we work closely with the academia, and also we are in industry, so it can be our role can be a bridge of the academia and the industry. We can engineer the concepts of the science to a potential commercial products.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us about your work and the Mosquito Project and silicon qubits and all those things. I wish you the best of luck as you take the next steps in your research. And thank you very much for coming on the Physics World podcast.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So finally this week, we're going to go back to last week's podcast when my colleague Sarah Tesh set all of you listeners a series of puzzles based on, I think, physics and film titles. It was very silly. Okay. I'm pleased to say that we've got Sarah back on to give out the answers. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Margaret.
So, Sarah, for the benefit of people who didn't listen last week, do you want to explain what this puzzle was all about? We were celebrating physics and film. That was the context. So what was the puzzle about?
So the game worked like this. I would give you a clue, mm-hmm. Which described a physicist and a film, and they could be joined by some sort of wordplay, not through anything to do with the context of the film or the physicists themselves and what they've done in their life.
Okay.
And this was all linked to the fact that we had the special issue in November on the physics of film.
Right.
So do you want to know the answers?
Yes, we are actually dying to know what were the answers.
I'm sure you are. Okay, so the clue, I'll give you, the clue for the first one was, gifted with obedience by a fairy, astrophysicist famous for the discovery of pulsars has to hide her curse from her new stepfamily in this adaptation of Cinderella. Any ideas, Margaret?
Well, I know the discovery of pulsars, which I think Mateen also knew last week, but I'm completely clueless about the rest. Go for it.
So it's Jocelyn Bell Burnella Enchanted. As in Ella Enchanted.
I haven't seen that film. Sorry. Haven't even heard of that one.
I think it starred Anne Hathaway.
Okay, yeah. Well, I've at least heard
eons
of her.
Eons ago. Okay, so the next one was, in this romantic comedy drama musical, engineer and inventor best known for his contributions to AC electricity, dances with an aspiring actress in a yellow dress on a vista overlooking LA.
Okay, this actually sounds like a plot of a film I would actually watch. So, Tesla?
Yes.
And La La Land?
Yes.
Tesla La Land?
Correct. Well done. You're so proud of yourself right now, aren't you?
I'm ashamed of myself having got that. Right, okay.
Okay, so finally, the third one I gave out was this. Italian astronomer from the 16th century wants to escape the London drug business in this British crime film. That's quite a generic clue for that last bit.
I mean, I would actually watch that film as well, see if it really existed. But apart from knowing, I'm guessing it's going to be Galileo.
Yes. So it was Galileo cake.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Sarah, that's terrible.
Yeah, but at the same time, you love it.
Yeah. Well, so it does give me an excuse to mention my favorite Galileo fact, which is that while he was under house arrest late in his life, he was actually recruited by a university in the U.S.
Oh.
So you don't think of Harvard University and Galileo as being things that overlapped in time at all, but Harvard University invited Galileo to be a professor. He declined because his health wouldn't have survived this massive transatlantic voyage at the time. But just, you know, yeah, the history is weird this way. You know, how would have things have been different if Galileo had gone to Harvard instead of staying in Pisa, was it? Yeah, I can't remember. Anyway, in Italy. Right, so thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. My thanks to Tammy Freeman, Fernando Gonzalez-Zalba, Sunya Yang, and Alessandro Rossi, and a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via Apple Podcasts or another podcast app of your choice, or you can follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.